It sounds just a little bit like the old Al Capp comic strip, Lil Abner, that had, from time to time, stories about something called the Kick Me, which was a sort of a bowling pin-shaped creature who was so eager to please people that he would jump into a frying pan and fry himself up just for the pleasure of serving man. Well, something like that is the critter on this planet that we're about to encounter. The critter will drop dead for human convenience, but just be careful what you eat. In this story from X-1, it's called Drop Dead, and it comes to us from August 22nd, 1957.
Countdown for blast off. X-5, 4, 3, 2, X-1, fire. From the far horizons of the unknown come tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future, adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on a thousand maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, presents
X-1.
Tonight, the Clifford D. Simak story, Drop Dead. But first, hear this.
Have you ever asked yourself what this country's most important natural resource is? I'm Dorothy Olsen, NBC Bandstand singing schoolteacher. Our most important resource? Well, you might consider it our mineral deposits, or our tremendous sources of water power, or maybe our great forests. Well, these are all very important natural resources, but there's one resource that's more important than all these combined, our children. Don't neglect them or their educational facilities. Poor schools breed inadequate citizens for tomorrow. And another thing, keep your youngsters in tip-top shape so that they won't miss important school days. Dress them against the weather so they won't catch needless winter colds. Check their wardrobe as they go back to school this fall to be sure that they have plenty of the right kind of clothing. Remember, our children are this nation's most important natural resource. It's your job to protect their future as they go back to school this fall.
Now, X-1, and the story of an unbelievable planet. Listen to Drop Dead.
Exactly 1 hour and 20 minutes after we sent the survey ship out on its tail, the critters showed up. Ordinarily, when you make a landing on an unknown planet, it takes at least a week for any life to come creeping out of hiding and sneak a look. But there they were, the critters. They were almost cow-sized, but not as graceful as a cow. Their bodies were put together as if every blessed one of them had run full tilt into a wall. Their hides were splashed with large squares of pastel colors, the kind of color one never finds on any self-respecting animal. Violet, pink, orange, chartreuse. The overall effect was in a checkerboard made by an old lady who did crazy quilts. Max Weber, our biologist, stood at the tail fin with me and stared.
Look at that on their heads. Those antlers.
Those are not antlers, my friend.
Well, I was afraid to say it. It looks like vegetation. As if they were trying to hide behind a skimpy thicket.
And what bothers me is the fruit and vegetables. That is fruit and vegetables growing on their heads.
Hey, watch it. One of them's broken away from the herd and coming over this way.
Step back. Give me a clear shot in case it charges.
Look, here it comes.
What?
How do you like that? It just dropped.
Ed, that animal just walked up to us and dropped dead.
We left the critter lying where it fell and started to set up camp. Carl Parsons, our ecologist, had the stove together and the supper started before the last tent peg was driven. I dug out my diet kit and mixed up my formula, and all of them kidded me about it the way they always did. It didn't bother me. Their kidding was automatic, and I had automatic answers. I know ulcers must sound silly and archaic. You ask any medic, he'll tell you they don't happen anymore. But I have a riddled stomach and a special diet kit to prove that they sometimes do. After supper, Carl Parsons, the ecologist, Max and I dragged the critter in and had a good look at it.
Hey, look at this, Ed. This animal's got different colored blocks on it, just like a checkerboard. Look at this one.
Holes.
Yeah. Just like one of those peg sets a kid uses as toys. Here, look what I found out of that. I'll poke it with my knife. There.
Looks like a bee.
Well, it is. On top of being a tomato bush and a grapevine, this critter is a walking beehive.
Why couldn't they be something simple?
Yeah, it never is.
You know, this is a screwy place.
The critters?
No, not the critters. The planet itself. Never saw one like it. It's positively naked. No trees, no flowers, nothing. Almost as if someone had said, let's make a simple planet. Let's cut out all the frills. Let's skip all the biological experiments and just work on the basics. One form of life and the grass for it to eat.
We unshipped the experimental animals, the rats, the Zartils from Centauri and the Punkins from Polaris. The Punkins made an unholy racket because Punkins are always hungry. You just can't give them enough to eat. You turn them loose and they eat themselves to death. We got them all unshipped and set up under a shed in rows when Max walked up to me thoughtfully, chewing on a toothpick the way he always did.
Ed, there's something wrong.
What do you mean?
There are no insects here. I wandered around, laid down in a dozen different places. Stands to reason a man should find some insects if he looked all morning. It is natural.
What about the bees?
What bees?
Well, the ones that were in the critter. Didn't you see any?
No, I didn't get close to any critter herds.
Birds?
Not a one. Oh, I was wrong about the flowers. The grass is tiny flowers.
For the bees to work on.
Very neat, isn't it?
I'm not so sure.
Now back to X-1 and the Clifford Simak story, Drop Dead.
The bio team had the critter spread out on a canvas tarp. They were happily chopping him up in small pieces with a scalpel.
Ed, I've got news for you. No brain.
What?
No brain. We can't find one, and there's no nervous system.
That's impossible. How can a highly organized, complex animal exist without a brain or nervous system?
It's got everything else. As near as we can figure it out, there are at least a dozen different kinds of flesh. Some fish, some fowl, some good red meat, maybe even a little lizard.
Well, an all-purpose animal. We found something, finally.
If it's edible, and if it doesn't poison you, if it doesn't grow hair all over you.
Well, that's up to you, fellas. I'll get the cages down, and you can start killing off the little animals to your heart's content.
And there's only one insect, these bees. And we never see these unless we're near a critter herd. And no birds, no fish in the water, not even a single-cell paramecium.
Yeah, I was talking it over with Max.
You know, I'd give my right arm to hear a cricket or a mosquito or even a hornet.
This is the strangest thing we've... Hey, Max, what are you chewing?
A toothpick.
That's no toothpick. Spit it out. Spit it out.
Hmm?
That's grass.
Well, I don't know. I must have just picked it automatically to chew on. Just a habit, I guess.
Yeah. Well, go on with the report.
Well, it's a walking filet mignon. That animal is an all-purpose for sure. It lays eggs, gives milk, and has 6 different kinds of red meat. Makes honey, 2 kinds of fowl, 1 of fish, and a whole lot of others we can't identify.
Then, of course, the bacteria.
And what about the bacteria?
The critters swarm with them. And all of them the same. You know, it normally takes 100 different kinds of bacteria to make the metabolism work. But here there's only one. It must do all the work of the 100 other species do. I wouldn't be surprised if that's the brains and the nervous system you couldn't find with your knife. The bacteria doubling in brass for both systems.
The whole place balances. Nature's never static, never standing still. But here on this planet, it's standing still. Where's the competition? Where's the evolution? It's as if long ago all these life forms said, let's quit this feuding. Let's get together. Let's cooperate. Symbiosis.
Well, we need another critter to work on.
I'll bet you we get it.
Luckily, Max didn't take Carl's bet. Right after breakfast, the critter came in and died with a savoir-faire that was positively marvelous. We unloaded all our supplies and got ready for a long stay. We were feeding all the experimental animals on a critter now. The carnivorous ones ate the critter meat, and the vegetarians chomped on critter fruit and critter vegetables. They all grew sleek and sassy. We were sitting around after supper one night when suddenly we heard something.
Hey!
What is it?
Listen!
Thunder!
Listen!
I think... All right, quick! Everybody up into the ship!
What is it?
A herd of critters. Look, you see the dust? They're coming this way in a stampede.
We swarmed up the ladder and tumbled into the port. Below us, the stampeding critters went grinding through camp. There seemed to be millions of them. They came pouring past for almost an hour. When it was all done, we came down and surveyed the damage.
Well, the animals are safe. They were under the tail fins.
Everything else is gone. Tents carried away.
Food supply is gone.
How about the emergency rations in the ship?
I had to move them down to the supply tent so they'd be handy. They're gone, dashed into the mud.
Well, even if we lifted ship immediately, it's at least 7 weeks to the nearest contact point. And no rations.
Well, gentlemen, I suggest you try on your bibs. There'll be steak for dinner.
Steak?
That's right. Steak or fowl or fish or honey, whichever you like.
You mean eat critter?
You got any other ideas?
Well, for one time, Ed, I wish I had your ulcers. You've got your diet kept in your pack, right?
Yeah.
Well, let's get a good fire going and throw on a chunk of critter.
The crew ate about a critter a day. They didn't seem to mind. Just at breakfast time, one would walk in and keel over. The crew ate like there was no tomorrow. I waited for them to break out in a rash or start turning green with purple spots or grow scales or something. But nothing happened. They felt better than they ever had. But then one morning, Max Weber turned up sick.
Well, gentlemen, I've just taken a sample of my own blood.
How do you feel?
Lousy. I'm loaded with bacteria, critter bacteria. I've checked some of the others. They've got a lower count than I have.
Well, that figures. You got a head start.
No.
The rest of them have just been eating critter for a week. They remember the day you ran out of toothpicks and took to chewing on a grass stem?
Well, we can't stop eating critter. It's all the food we have.
Well, we might stop eating critter now. And there's my diet kit. We might make it home.
Your diet kit wouldn't last us 3 days.
I took a blood sample on the test animals. They've got a bacteria count almost as high as mine.
Well, it doesn't make any difference. We still have to eat critter. We haven't got any choice.
That night, Weber disappeared. We hunted him for 3 days. He couldn't have gone very far, but we didn't find him. We did find one queer thing, though.
Hey, over here! Down in the gully!
What is it?
That white fungus, kind of a ball. It wasn't here last week.
We couldn't find Weber. And then about 4 days later, Carl woke me up.
Ed, get up. Get up.
What's the matter?
The animals. The test animals. They're insisting. They're turning into cocoons or chrysalis or something.
What?
All of the test animals, the guinea pigs, the dogs, they're turning into white fungus balls.
Carl, the ball we found out in the field.
Weber. Max Weber. It's got to be.
We had some trouble finding the place because the land was so flat and featureless. We finally located it just as dusk was setting in.
It split.
It looks like an egg after a chicken's been hatched. Carl?
Well, what do you think?
Look inside. There are two halves of that cocoon. Look at the marks. You can see what it is now.
Ed, you're the only one who has a chance. I think you should leave right now. Get back to the center and tell them. You've got your diet kit. You can make it. No wonder there are just the critters here. Take one drink of water, chew a single grass stem, take one bite of critter. Do any one of those things and you turn into one of them. Listen, Ed, you take your diet kit and notes and get out of here.
But I can't run out on you.
Forget us. We're not human anymore. You must not stay. If you do, in a day or two, a critter will come in and drop dead for you. And you'll go crazy all the way back home, wondering which one of us it was.
I walked slowly over to the ship and I stood at the foot of the ladder, holding the notes and the diet kit against my chest. I thought of all the things we'd been through together. The crew, how they'd always kidded me about the diet kit. I thought of almost 10 years eating that awful goo, and that I could never eat like a normal human because of my ulcerated stomach. Maybe they were the lucky ones, I told myself. If a man got turned into a critter, he'd probably come out with a whole stomach and never worry about how much or what he ate. The critters never ate anything except the grass. But maybe, I thought, that grass tasted just as good to them as steak or a pumpkin pie would taste to me. So I stood there for a while and I thought about it.
Ed, what are you doing back here?
Carl, I just took that diet kit and threw it out into the waste disposal unit.
What are you talking about?
My friend, I am very hungry. What have you got for supper?
Fred Collins speaking. And I'll have another word for you about X-1 in a moment.
Hi. This is Walter O'Keefe. You know, they say there's nothing new under the sun, and maybe that's true. But there is something new under the moon, and that's Nightline. In Nightline, we think we found the way to use the intimacy as well as the lightning-fast maneuverability of radio in an hour-and-a-half package of high-voltage, different entertainment. We found the way to make the airwaves your magic carpet to wherever big things are happening, anywhere in the country, for that matter, anywhere in the world. Now, let's say that your favorite comedian is performing at a Las Vegas nightclub. He's packing them in, and you've really got to have connections to get a table. Well, Nightline is that connection, and your radio is your ringside table. More things than you'd believe are happening in the so-called still of the night, and Nightline is your line to exciting entertainment after dark. My feeling is Nightline marks a new era in nighttime entertainment. Tune us in every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, and you'll hear what I mean.
You have just heard X-1, presented by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, which this month features Double Indemnity by Robert Sheckley. To commit the perfect crime, all Barthold needed was centuries in which to plan it and execute it, and an insurance policy with Double Indemnity. Galaxy Magazine, on your newsstand today. Tonight, X-1 has brought you Drop Dead, a story written by Clifford D. Simak and adapted for radio by Ernest Canoy. Featured in our cast were Lawson Zerbe as Ed, Ralph Camargo as Max Weber, and Joseph Bell as Carl Parsons. Your announcer, Fred Collins. X-1 was directed by George Voutsas and is an NBC Radio Network production.
Well, you knew there had to be a catch. Those critters were just so accommodating. That was Drop Dead, as said, from X-1, August 22nd, 1957. Our next stop for old-time radio drama takes us back to 1945 with Savage Encounter, right after this. You're listening to old-time radio drama on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And from radio great Norman Corwin, one of the great writers and producers, still going strong at the age of 97 out there in Los Angeles, we have an entry from August 7th, 1945, starring Glenn Ford as a Pacific aviator who bails out and finds himself in a civilization that's very difficult for him to understand, and the feeling is mutual. In Savage Encounter, Columbia presents Corwin from August 7th, 1945.
Columbia presents Corwin. Tonight, in the sixth of his series of eight broadcasts for CBS, Norman Corwin brings you the distinguished actor of films and radio, Glenn Ford, in a repeat performance of Savage Encounter. The original musical score is by Harry Simeon and is conducted by Lud Gluskin. Glenn Ford in Norman Corwin's Savage Encounter.
My name is unimportant, and you will understand soon enough why I must omit certain details from the telling of this story. I was flying a seaplane in an area of the South Pacific en route to my base when I ran into a heavy electric storm. For upward of 3 hours, I flew blind, not knowing where I was and unable to see what lay below me. It was getting dark, and I had only about 20 minutes of fuel left when suddenly enough current caught the plane and lifted it with a cyclonic force 6 or 7,000 feet in a few seconds. And then, as though I were coming out of a dream, only to enter another, I was above the storm, and I saw rising before me a mountain peak, silhouetted against the pearly wash of a clearing sky lit by the full moon. There was nothing to do now but fly with the wind, negotiate the extremely narrow pass, and bail out on the other side. But once through the pass, I was dismayed to see dense forests on the other side. I jumped, having no other choice. And the wind was so strong it carried my descent for miles. I finally hit the treetop with such force that I must have been knocked out. Because when I awoke, it was day. I was in a forest of vine-covered trees that rose straight for 100 feet, interlocking at their tops to form a ceiling of leaves. There was a green glow all about. Gradually, I felt an instinctive alarm, and for good reason. There was something behind me. I got to my feet, but whatever it was that was standing in the brush, it didn't move. I took a step toward it. With a quick movement, the branches between us parted, and there came forward a native. He was about 7 feet tall, handsomely proportioned, his skin a coppery bronze in the shadows. I addressed him. "Speaky English?" He looked at me with fixed expression. I tried again. "You know how speaky? You friend, white fella?" He came closer, studied the wounds on my face for a moment, and then said an astonishing thing.
"What dialect of a decent tongue are you mouthing?"
"You speak English? Oh, that's a break. I was afraid I might have come down in enemy territory. What island is this? Where's the base around here?"
"Base? Enemy territory? What does that mean?"
"Why, don't you know? The enemy, the Japs, the... You mean you don't?"
"Has your wound disfigured you?"
"This what?"
"Whatever this cumbrance round your feet, cast it off and come with me."
"Well, this is a parachute. I bailed out in it last night. Saved my life."
"I see.
What did you say the name of this island was?"
"Come with me. Come. Follow me."
He led me down to a stream along which we traveled for some time. During this, he said very little. Most of the way, he preceded me on the narrow trail, and so couldn't speak conveniently. But at one point, he stopped and turned to me with a wide grin.
"Yes, we speak English." Was I in a delirium? How else to explain the language of this native? His speech was certainly English, but it was a kind that I'd never heard before. Antique, archaic, stilted, strangely formed. We finally arrived at a place which, by my own promise and all I hold sacred, I cannot describe to you. It was a fair place, a beautiful place. That's almost the only way I can describe it. It was modest and livable. Above all, there was a dignity of life in that place that I'd never seen before. My rescuer and guide took me through curious and animated crowds to a place of assembly where a council was in session. They rose at my entrance, greeted me with silent nods, and listened to my friend's report. He delivered it with high humor, telling them how, while hunting, he had looked up and seen an odd object
descending in the sky. "And I thought, what, a rickish pollen coming on the wind to breed with trees and make new combines of flora? For we see so much of jesting nature here. Fish flipping to the fin tip, and birds jocose from sunrim to night peep. I was prepared for some out-country creature conceived upon a mountain riverbed by low-lying vapors. And as he had not been discharged by any cloud that I could see above me, he couldn't have been a dewdrop."
I saw the laughter was not at my expense, for they seemed kindly disposed. And when my discoverer had finished, the leader of the council came over to where I was standing and took my hand.
"We welcome you to these woods, to the fruit of our gardens and the produce of our hands. We invite you to take of us and be of us, to convive happily, both in our own name and in the name of Thomas, your brother, whose memory is quick and ageless among our nation.
I was too dazed at the moment to make any special note of his reference to Thomas, for immediately the others of the council approached and took my hand, and each greeted me. Something was said about my needing rest, and I was taken to a cottage overlooking the gardens of the... But I must be careful not to describe too much of this place. Again, for reasons you should think. I was numb from my head wound and intoxicated by the brilliance of my surroundings, but once I had eaten, I yielded to fatigue and fell into a deep sleep. As though every level of my consciousness had been affected by this experience. Even my dreams were pleasant and full of exotic music. Something tonic in the atmosphere, I awoke fresh and clear-headed, my injury well on its way to healing, and my spirits unaccountably light. And the events of that day served only to heighten this feeling. I was regarded by all with a sort of open affection that I always thought the province only of lifelong friends. Children flocked around me when I went about in the streets as though I were a favorite uncle. There was no superstition or mystic awe mixed up in it. The people of this place simply were happy to see me and didn't hesitate to show it. On the fifth evening, there was an occasion in my honor. Music and dancing, and speaking of poetry. But even if that night had not been otherwise charged with sensation, I should remember it all my life for one thing. It was then and there that I met Ara, daughter of the leader of the council. Ara, of the blue-black hair and eyes that outshone the proudest constellation in the heavens. Ara, oh blessed name. It was Ara who told me about Thomas as we walked by the lakeshore afterward, hands clasped. How a man was cast up on the far shores of their island 3 centuries ago, the only survivor of a shipwreck.
Tall as we, your color, white hair. A legend writ of him in after years swore that a cloud stayed on his brow, a very cumulus of consideration.
How he had been a profound and good and forceful man. And a student of the great poets of his time.
Shakespeare and Marlowe and Webster. He bore their sea-soaked pages as the Libard fairies are young. Purposely, tenderly, yet with a haughty and prideful eye.
How he had found her people so gifted of intellect, so benignly civil, so acquisitive of knowledge that he gave up all thought of returning to his own country. He lived among them, telling them little of the temporal matters of his own world, but teaching them all the best of its poetry. And so great was the native genius for the spoken word, so complete their fascination in it, that soon English came to be their second tongue.
And growing supple with usage, became at last our elected speech, for we pitched upon it.
This, then, explained the peculiar idiom spoken here.
Yes, why did you say a transplanted language, flourishing like some wind-blown and accidental seed? Dropped in foreign soil.
Apparently, Thomas was hitherto the only white man they'd ever seen, and I was, in effect, the first bulletin from the outside world in more than 300 years. Thus, I suppose it was natural that they should think me the same stripe as the sainted Thomas. For my part, I fully reciprocated the kind attitudes they displayed toward me. And as for my feelings for Ara, it started the night I dined, or convived, as they put it, at the place of Taram, Ara's father.
I was talking with an elder named Shargo when, in the course of conversation, I began to expand on the subject of my adventures in the war. Quickly, the room fell silent. I attributed this to the interest they took in my story. And with growing eloquence, I admit I was somewhat animated by drink and perhaps more loquacious than usual, I recounted briefly the history of the outer world since the time of Thomas. Its wars, its industrialization, its panics, its depressions. I told them about the wonders of radio and the airplane, as well as the various uses to which they had been put. They listened without a word, at times looking at each other quizzically, but never interrupting. I told them of the First World War and of the intervening years, of the origins and career of World War II. At length, Tara made a little gesture as if to speak. I stopped.
You tell us, then, that 30 years ago, your people slaughtered 20 millions of each other with cruel murdering pieces.
Why, yes, 1914 to 18.
And now today, simult with our sitting here, your nations are killing once again.
Yes, we're already about 20 million killed in this one so far, and it's not over yet by any means.
And nothing learnt between. Nothing extraught from the many wars and bloody garboil?
Oh, sure, in a way. Sure, we've learned how to kill more efficiently. A war is a full-blown science now.
Tell us more.
I went on, encouraged by the amazement and astonishment on the faces of my hosts. And when I had finished, I sat back, pleased with my account. For a moment, nobody spoke. Then Taram rose.
The night is old and the moon is set. We must part now. Our fellowly guest shall be escorted home. But I would have the council remain.
I thought it peculiar that the party, which began so informally, should end in this manner, and that I should be assigned an escort, when up to now it had been considered quite all right for me to go about alone. And I was still more puzzled when, as I was leaving and started to cross the room to say goodnight to Ara, I was intercepted by Shargo, ostensibly for the purpose of asking me a question. It was a small, pointless question, and I'm sure merely a ruse to delay me, for upon disengaging myself from Shargo, I noticed Ara was no longer in the room. The attitude of my host seemed to have changed. They were so courteous and kind that I found that fewer people spoke to me, and these less freely than before. I was detained close by my cottage on this excuse and that. And what concerned me even more was the fact that, though I'd been seeing Ara daily since we met, she was now mysteriously absent from her father's house. I made inquiries for her, and Taram explained.
Ara has gone to the lakes on errand.
Oh, when will she be back?
I cannot say.
I returned, sullen, to my cottage, and was shocked to find that on the pretext of needed repairs to its roof, I was being moved up to what they called the High Holt, a wooded section some distance from the gardens. The new place was even larger and more luxurious than the old one, but I was aware that the warm and open hospitality of the country had deteriorated to a sort of protective custody. I waited. For minutes, nothing stirred. Then something happened that made my blood freeze. No sooner had a cloud drifted across the moon and darkened the woods than a figure slipped through the curtains of the window, noiseless as a shadow, and was standing in the room above me. I rose to my elbow, my fingers tight around my knife. Who is it? Who is there?
It's I, Ara.
Oh, Ara, my love.
Oh,
Ara.
I'm forbode to see you, but I've stolen away here to tell you of the danger.
What danger?
They've marked you out as savage.
I, a savage?
Yes, but they say you come of ugsome people. The society is full wasted by greed and savage instinct.
But, Dara, how can
I'm
they?
So quickly, I'll soon find out.
But why? What have I done?
They dredge will subvert our youth by story and example. And we are people of
what
such...
What do they intend to do with me?
I fear they will kill you on an unsuspecting moment.
But I thought they liked me.
Oh, they look on you fondly. But they're fearful. Lest all innocent you plant the cancer of your dispiteous world among us.
But I wouldn't do that.
I must go, beloved, till they discover me.
Oh, but Ara, you're not safe. Why did you come?
Because I loved you.
there, standing in the doorway, were two giant native guards. Silently, they came to Ara. One gently took her arm, and she went out between them, speaking not a word. They said nothing to me beyond apologizing for the disturbance.
We regret to have intruded on your privacy. Good night, sir, and deep sleep to you.
I expected my food to be poisoned, and so I didn't eat. I expected to be killed in my sleep, so I didn't sleep.
Shall the bed be ready?
No, I'm not tired.
You have not rested since Noonstead 2 days.
I tell you, I'm not tired. I'll let you know when I am.
We await your pleasure.
I expected them to pounce on me when I walked about in the holt, but nobody came near. Finally, I could stand it no longer. Guard!
You called, sir?
Look, see here. I've had enough of this. I demand to see Taraman immediately. Do you understand?
He shall be told.
I was sure this would do me no good, but... But to my great surprise, later that same day, Taram arrived at the holt. He was downcast and seemed much older than when I saw him last, as though he had been through a terrible ordeal. He bore bad news. Ara was being held for treason, and the council had decided that I must die. I asked them what they would do to Ara.
She, too, is under sentence.
You have made up your minds?
All but to hear you.
Hear me?
Our code is to inform the accused one of our charges and to hear him out.
Oh, what good will that do?
Little. Less than little. Not unless you're persuasive against the damning testaments of your own lips.
You're putting me on trial, is that it?
Yes. We are putting you on trial.
Ancient hospitalities, do what we must. For then and only then, good judges, can we be proof against unimaginable woes. This war, by his report, engluts all of the oceans of the world, save for this haply mirage-hidden island. How long, if he escape and does rejoin his usual barbaric company, should we stay unconsidered in their strategies?
But you have my word, I tell them nothing about you.
His word? Respected judges, he himself has told us of the history of treaties in his forlorn society.
You're deliberately misinterpreting what I said the other night.
Oh, this prosecution is small pleasure to us all. Consider him. In face, resembling Thomas. In language, uncouth but understandable. A brave and hardy fellow. Outwardly, a worthy and a gracious man. Yet, inward, what decay sits still and waits? How else than by a vile inheritance of blood could lusts and fratricidal passions so control the children of the fighters of the wars that they, the children, persist in making up and fighting new wars of their own? Is there no love among their schemes? Good judges, these are the risks of an acquittal. First, that he escapes. Next, that staying in our midst alive, he, by ingratiation and insisture, by devices uncanny, such as that which he calls radio, by the same perversions of wit and skill that have rendered this race of savages sovereign over the bird, will subtly and wickedly corrupt our people. Already he but touches a maiden, the noble daughter of our noblest leader, and she so deep contracts the special sickness of this savage that she hurries through the night to betray her people by forewarning him. We, all of us, agree and are together saddened that this very personable and by certain lights this innocent young man should, for the sake of the tranquility and peace of generations yet unnumbered on this island, be forfeit of his years and die under the sentence of this council. Yet these are good causes that I account here, the highest of all. And he, alas for him, is overmatched by them. For in his world, by all that he has freely told us, there is such bale, such epidemic misery, hunger amid great riches, and the lessons of catastrophe continuing unlearned, we cannot but assume some awful growth is rampant in their blood, breeding in cycles, and affecting finally the very seat of reason. Our guest, so logic and quiescent now, like Thomas of that old and better world, may be the carrier of a black plague striking the inner organs of the soul. We cannot risk this prospect in our nation. I call upon you to pronounce the edict of his execution in the name of the various peoples by whom you have been here deputed.
These are the weights against you, good friend, our guest. We shall listen if you wish to speak.
I certainly do wish to speak. First of all, get rid of any idea that I'd willingly stay here if you were to reprieve me on condition that I don't try to escape. Because I would try.
Well, he pleads the case against himself better than we.
I would try to escape to the very war which you've condemned, and by whose conduct you consider me a savage.
Why? Why?
Because I have a share of fighting yet to do in that war. And not even for this sublime island and all the dignity and sweetness of your life here would I remain while other men are dying for a cause that I consider just as sacred as you do your own. Listen. Any fool could understand your caution to keep this thing you have. But let me ask you something. Was it always this way here? Did you come out of the earth complete with laws and culture? Oh, it doesn't matter whether you came up from a tadpole or an ape. Somewhere along the line, you had to fight. You had to conquer beasts or else be conquered. Well, that's the way it is with us today. We're fighting beasts. Animals far wilder than anything you've ever had to face. We're fighting the makers of wars. And that's not easy for people who, like you, are brought up to prefer peace. You make the mistake of lumping together as savages the makers of war and the breakers of war. Oh, there's a difference between the two. And men are willing to die for that difference. We call them men of goodwill. And there are millions of them fighting for just such a kind of life as you've got here. How do you mean to say that you deny to others the blessings you have found? Can it mean that you're willing to take but not give? You took what Thomas had to offer and you found it good enough to make a saint of him. Well, I can tell you that there are many Thomases, present and future, who can bring you countless good and wonderful things and will. After we've finished with the fascists. Before this war, all of our countries were islands, like yourself. Each one of us cut off in spirit from the rest of the world, as you are cut off, in fact. But now we're together, and the leaders are meeting. And one nation gives to the other what it needs, as you people do here among yourselves. Well, that's where we stand. As for you, you can sit alone if you choose and hoard your riches like a miser counting gold, or else you can help those who are poor in wisdom to reach what seems to you so obvious and easy, simply because you reached it so long ago. In a very small way, you can start helping by letting me go back to the fight. But whatever you decide to do to me, what about Ara? She's accused of treason. Why? Because she ran through the woods to warn the man she loves? That's not treason. Oh, treason is deliberate and studied. Not a girl's panic for the safety of her lover in the night.
Is there no love among your schemes? I say to you, release us. Let her go. Let me go. And I will make a vow to tell nobody where to look for you. At least, not until our civilization is worthy of your acquaintance. That's all I have to say.
Goodbye, my old Alyssa. Go safely. And my love be constant with you.
Goodbye, beloved. Beloved Ara.
May you find the way to your people. And may your people find their way to peace.
I'll try to come back, Ara. And if I can't, my world will come to you. And it will be a part of me as I am a part of it.
I shall dream forever of the all of you.
Once more I fill my eyes with your face. And then I go. All right, friend, the blindfold.
Here. Does it bind too close?
No, it's comfortable.
So, take my hand.
And so, blindfolded, I was led up the slopes and through the pass. It was an extra precaution on the part of my hosts, but quite unnecessary. One day, when all the savagery of inhumanity to man is rooted out, when all the many inequalities are evened up all over the whole of our known world, when we have won, I shall borrow a plane. I shall head for a certain quadrant of a certain ocean. And then I shall look for a storm to get lost in.
You have been listening to Glenn Ford as the pilot in Savage Encounter, a fantasy for radio, written, directed, and produced by Norman Corwin, as the sixth in a special series of broadcasts under the familiar title, Columbia Presents Corwin. Harry Simeon composed the musical score, which was conducted by Lud Gluskin. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.